Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by David again. David, how are you?
I'm quite well. Yourself?
Good, good. Now, we didn't see you for a couple, including one that was hard to not have you for, which was our 3D one at NAB, but we're glad to have you back now.
Yeah, I missed being part of the stereo show, but I really couldn't have said anything without hunting down every member of our audience and killing them for knowing what I know.
We had a couple of good ring-ins in people like Ron Brinkman, so it was good.
Yeah, and I appreciated the mention on the show as well.
So this week we're talking about Iron Man, which I must admit caught me off guard as to both how much of a response the film would get, how well it would go at the box office, and actually how much I enjoyed it.
I personally have been looking forward to it for quite a while. I was expecting it to be really fantastic, and it was.
Now, why was that? Why did you think? So, why were you looking forward to it, and why did you think it was going to be good?
Well, they filmed it next door to us, like literally across the street from us. So, I was privy to a little bit of sneak preview during
Playa Vista.
At Playa Vista, yeah. Right. The stage right next to ours is where they filmed both Transformers and Iron Man. And also last summer at Comic-Con, there was a little sneak preview given, and as soon as I saw that, I was like, Favreau nailed it, because Iron Man is one of my favorite characters, so I was a little bit hesitant over whether he could get it correct, and he did.
Okay, so now this is interesting, because I am not a aficionado of the Iron Man comics, and it sounds like you knew the character going in much better than I did.
I was a tremendous nerd growing up, and read a lot of comics, and Iron Man was always one of my favorites. I'm a big fan of the superheroes who choose to be superheroes of their own volition, like Batman or Iron Man. You know, not that they're given some sort of ability or that they're born with it. You know, people who make themselves a superhero always kind of fascinated me, and I really enjoyed.
We'll get to the visual effects and discuss it in most depth in a minute, but let's just cover off a few other things. You mentioned the director, who is also somebody who's done a lot of acting. In fact, has been in a bunch of major films himself as an actor. Had you noticed any of his other films in a directorial role before?
Absolutely. Actually, when I was at Sony, he came to ImageWorks to do Zathura, and I got to meet him a couple times in the lobby, back and forth, or with where he was standing in line to get breakfast. And he's a really nice guy, really down to earth. I first noticed Favreau in, even though he didn't direct it, Doug Liman directed Swingers, but Favreau wrote it, and that's where he kind of came to my attention. And then, you know, Zathura is quite a well put together film. You know, I didn't like Elf, but that's because of my pure and utter loathing for Will Ferrell as a comedian. But the movie of Zathura is just, you know, it was billed as a sequel to Jumanji, which did it kind of a disservice. But it's a really well put together movie. The story moves along in a really well mannered, and that really brought him to my attention as a director. The guy can direct. He's an actor's director.
Having Stranger as Fiction is one of my all-time favorite films, I'll disagree with you over Will, but
I will agree with you there. I really enjoyed Will Ferrell in Stranger Than Fiction. I just don't enjoy him as a comedic actor.
So Favreau came from a background in improv, right? He did like Chicago Improv Olympics stuff, and he's kind of an actor's actor in the sense that I wonder, because it didn't strike me that he was the obvious director, nor that Downey Jr. was the obvious lead. Was that something before the film came out that occurred to you? I guess you knew the director, so you liked him.
Knowing is kind of a strong word, but it's one of those things that when you see him attached to it, you're kind of like, really? Him? I had the same reaction when Bryan Singer got attached to X-Men, because you're kind of like, really? The Usual Suspects guy? But I always, I guess I'm a little bit worried more now when you see the obvious director attached to the obvious movie. Because when you're coming at it for, you know, kind of an outside the box choice, maybe in a way they will do more research and be more diligent about trying to stay true to what the fans will, you know, being very conscious of the idea that that they want to make a movie the fans will respond to versus somebody who might be a complete fanboy of the comic book or the character, and therefore in their brain have these ideas that, oh well, I know who, man, I don't want to name any names of characters, but you know, I know who this guy is, and therefore I'll go off and put my own little spin on it that I've always wanted to do since I was 13 years old, and that could possibly turn the character into something it's not, or well, that he's.
Let me ask you this, because before we get into the visual effects stuff, which obviously is a lot of 1,000 shots, but I've been interested to find somebody that was a fan, because at the fan level, there's an enormous amount of history, the suit, it evolves. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, just from doing some basic research, in the comic book world, his suit involves nanotechnology, and it's kind of fused with his body, and there's crossovers with him attacking Wolverine, and he appeared first with the Hulk or something. I mean, in all of that, does the film just seem superficial to a fan, or is it because it can't possibly get that far along with that many years of history from the comic books?
No, it can't get into that kind of detail, and I think it doesn't need to. Iron Man has always been about, you know, a human being who is completely and utterly flawed. You know, he's in the comic, he's an alcoholic. He was a, you know, kind of. It's kind of like how Robert Downey Jr. played him and how Robert Downey Jr. was in real life, where he kind of almost destroyed his entire career and his life with drugs and alcohol and arrogance and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, through this massive life-changing experience, decides that he needs to put his gifts, his brain power, in the case of Tony Stark, to use of bettering humanity. And it's, you know, it's not a, he's not forced into it. It's not something he has to do. It's a choice. And the essential parts of the character are all there in this movie. And it's really, that's what a superhero movie is really about. If you try to do this whole, you know, you build the whole world, you can get lost in it. And you lose what the character is about. I think that's why people responded to this movie so well, because while there's the really cool action sequences and all that, they spend just as much time dealing with Tony Stark, the man, as they do Iron Man, the hero. And I think that's why it's so successful as a movie, that they didn't kind of try to shoehorn in 40 years of history into the movie.
Well, and you said it's successful, and obviously it's done a great box office. Interestingly, it's also one of the first pictures, or the first picture, that Marvel Studios has self-funded. So they must be pretty happy.
Yeah, I'm sure that both they and Paramount are pretty darn happy. And I'm glad you mentioned the Marvel Studios thing, because it's kind of where Marvel has had a problem with their film franchise versus DC as a comic book thing, because, you know, DC is owned by Warner Brothers, which is owned by Time Warner, and they can kind of mix and match among their people, even though they haven't done it. But what Marvel Studios is doing now is, you know, they have the Incredible Hulk is coming out in a month or two with Patrick Norton, I think it's Patrick Norton playing the Incredible Hulk. And that's going to be released by Universal Studios. But Downey is making a cameo in that film as Tony Stark, even though Iron Man was released by a competing studio. And you could have never done that. So it gives them the opportunity to expand their kind of huge history of characters, you know, into the film world. You know, so you could theoretically see what you were just talking about, Iron Man, you know, meeting with the X-Men, even though the X-Men is a Fox movie or whatever. So it's interesting that they wound up making their own studio.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Well, let's swing our attention over to the visual effects. And John Nelson was the visual effects supervisor from obviously such films as Gladiator and before that Matrix and stuff. He won the Oscar on Gladiator. And ILM was the principal house with Stan Winston doing the suits. There was the orphanage, and I'll come back to them in a second. Embassy, New Deal. I think also Lola did some stuff, though. We never hear what Lola does because Lola's always just doing actor fix-ups. But Gentle Giant was credited, and Gentle Giant's actually on your film, aren't they?
Not Gentle Giant. Although Gentle Giant is working with us on Avatar, Giant Studios, which is a mocap facility.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They're also located at Playa Vista, although they did just move. It's people get that confusion all the time.
Well, my bad. And I think there was a couple of other companies that did stuff as well. Now let's discuss obviously ILM. I think it was Ben Snow that championed their work at the facility, and he does just a tremendous record of doing really good stuff for ILM, hasn't he?
Definitely. Both he and the animation supervisor on the film, Hal Hickel, who has a slight disclaimer, is a good friend of mine. I think both did tremendous work on this film.
Yeah. There's 1,000 visual effect shots, and as we said, ILM took the brunt of them. So I think it's fair to say that they still did a lot of stuff where they could in camera. In fact, that's proven, I guess, by the complex wire work that Zero G did in the lab scene. And just a disclaimer, we're about to start doing spoilers. So if you haven't seen the film, unfortunately, this is it. Can't discuss it without giving some stuff away. So yeah, so in that lab stuff, they had some pretty interesting wire rigs, didn't they, David?
Yeah. You know, wire rigs for people flying are sometimes tricky. You kind of get used to seeing, when you see somebody flying, the fact that they're going to have cables attached to their waist or maybe to their back. But you'll see it a lot where if they're attached to the waist, that they're obviously pivoting around their waist, or possibly they'll be using a spinner ring, which means that the cables are attached to the side of the ring and then they're able to twist within the ring. But the way they built this kind of complex multiple pulley system where, you know, it's almost like he was skiing on these kind of platforms on his feet, so that if he moved to the right with his legs, he would kind of fly to the right, and they gave him much more of a floaty feeling on these cables. It was apparently very strenuous on the actors, whether it was Downey Jr. himself or one of the stunties who was in the rig, but it was quite physically demanding, because you're basically standing there in a squat the entire time you're up in this rig, which I can't even imagine. Because they're obviously going to hoist them up and then say, roll cameras, everything like that. And it's to get maybe a 20-second take, you're going to have a whole bunch of preamble and postamble. And it's I can't even imagine the physical duress he was on under it. But it really came across as very authentic flying. I thought it was really well done, I thought.
Yeah, I think one of the other things that was restrictive in that setup is that his hand, the palm controllers, obviously orientated his flight path that had been established. And so you would normally stick your hands out to balance in a situation that you're acting like you don't want to flip up and stuff. But of course, if he suddenly moved his arms, that could be an NG take, because it would suggest his movement would change in the air. So it was actually kind of restrictive on what the actor could do to even balance or act on the rig.
Yeah, it must have been quite a challenge for Downey Jr.
I think another cute thing they did in terms of visual or special effects, which I hadn't picked up on, but the 800-pound Iron Munger suit that obviously Evil Guy gets.
Obadiah Stane.
Yes. And by the way, full marks to Jeff Bridges for actually bothering to shave his head for real, which I thought was a... Because when he first came on screen, I was like, man, is that a skull cap? If it is, they've done a really good job in hiding his hair. But anyway, on the Iron Munger, they used this gimbal rig to actually simulate it walking, because it took about like 5 guys to operate it. And I didn't pick that that's what they'd been doing to get that rig to move. And I, for a start, obviously, it would be easier just to replace things with CG when you're trying to get something that big to move around. But having it interacting on the stage, I'm sure, made a big difference to the actors.
Yeah, a huge difference. I know Favreau is a big fan of the practical. On Zathura, he wanted to use actual models, not CG, but actual models, and shoot them because he felt it gave a look. And having an actual thing on set, the suit for Iron Man was actually built, and they got to wear it. Ironmonger was actually built. It gives a one. It does aid the actors, rather than looking at some green tennis ball and saying, "No, really, it's a big, huge iron suit, and it's very scary." And ooh, now be afraid. It gives them something to react to. But the gimbal, big props to the filmmakers for doing that, because that would, then you start involving technicians and a whole bunch of other people that all have to be coordinated in order to pull your shot off. And
And you've got to wonder whether being an actor, like he was actually, the director was actually an actor in, like, say, Daredevil, right? I wonder if he's just had that frustration of being on set with a tennis ball, and that's why he gives his actors more than that.
It could be part of coming from an actor standpoint, but I also think it's, kind of the era he grew up in, the late 70s, early 80s, where you have things like Star Wars and Terminator, where you have something practical that you're reacting to, because that's what acting is. It's all the power of acting isn't coming from what you're generating, it's coming from what you're reacting to. And if you just have these kind of dead eyes kind of staring off into the distance, you're not going to give a plausible performance. But it I think for Jeff Bridges up there in this humongous suit, he's in there and he feels the power of this thing and the weight of this thing, and it gives him that inner energy that he needs to deliver the performance he did. And it's also, I think, really cool to have something practical on set that looks real. There's nothing more real looking than an actual thing they built, photographed in the real light, in the real environment. You don't have to worry about going out there and putting out a chrome sphere and taking photographs of it so you get HDRI, proper reflectance maps and all that kind of stuff, which I'm sure they did, to do the full replacements. But if you can, if you're editing and you have a tight close up, you have it. It's all in camera. You don't have to worry about the effects and whether it's gonna kind of work together. And I also think a nice kind of side effect of having a practical, proper suit, whether it's the Ironmonger suit or the Iron Man suits, is it keeps the visual effects, the all CG versions, very grounded, because it's you can't just go off into wacky animation land. You have to keep it matching the actual item that was there on the set, which
Yeah,
it
they lacked for me, which is a good thing, the stupid scenes where just because he was wearing a suit, he could survive, I don't know, a nuclear blast. I mean, there were a couple of obviously fantastical things that were going on there, right? But, as you were saying, like, it's kept it grounded, and to a certain extent, in their world of, being able to fly, at least they were fairly consistent with what he was managing to sort of pull off and stuff.
Yeah, it was your worry as a director is, if you're when you're directing a live actor, you're able to have your conversation with the actor, and the actor's gonna do what he's gonna do, but you're there on set reacting and guiding him into the performance that you want. If you turn over your character to the visual effects artist, that's a lot of trust, to. Because if your character's all digital, what your animators are doing is acting. They're delivering a performance of your character. And yeah, you're there guiding it, but because animation is such a laborious process, you never know. They might go off on a tangent for a few weeks or whatever till you have a time to look at the in-progress shot, and it may be completely off target of where you want. But by having a practical, physical thing there on set to identify with, and that you have to match in your long shot performances with your tight close up of an actual thing, it keeps it nice and grounded.
I couldn't agree more. I think that there's a certain groundedness in the whole film that works really well. I'm going to ask you now, were there particular sequences or shots and stuff that you thought were pulled off really, really well?
The one shot which, like, it literally, while I was watching the movie, I was like, I in my head went, that was really well done. And again, spoiler city. There's a scene in the movie where he's replacing the power cell in his chest, and he calls Gwyneth Paltrow down to, you know, stick her hand in his chest. And I thought that was just perfectly done.
Really? You know, really? That was the one? God, I don't know. I disagree with you there, man. And I'll tell you why. I could just, I mean, visually, there wasn't any seams, but I could just so tell that he was standing vertically and there was a prosthetic going forward, right? It was the, you know, trick from, I don't know, Star Trek, the with the chick coming down with the spine hanging down from the, you know, in the hive of the Borg. It was, you know, have actor on the operating table and have their chest, you know, being able to operate it on. He was so locked down there. And
the thing was about, you know, in my head, I was also going, like, I know exactly how this is done, but it was so well done. It was a great prosthetic. It was, you know, I just thought it was, I thought it was done well. I did also really, really love the F-22 sequence, where, you know, with the flying and where he's holding onto the bottom of the plane. I thought that was, you know, mentally in my head, I was making comparisons with that movie Stealth that came out a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, very, very realistic looking. You know,
because that is hard. That is really hard. You can't do any 3D tracking in an aerial like that because of clouds and stuff. So it's getting that to not look like they're flying horizontally or just completely fake. That's hard. That's hard work.
Yeah, and it was pulled off quite well. And I also was a big fan of the assembly sequence when he puts on the suit, you know, the red and gold suit, and you see it all coming together. I thought that was pretty darn cool.
Yeah, I think those are, you need a few of those sort of cool shots, and that was definitely a cool shot. I guess there was one shot for me that I thought was just a cracker that I would have put in the trailer in a second, and that was when he first lands in, okay, I'm going to say Bosnia, but it wasn't, and then or Afghanistan, and then fires at the tank. There's a shot, low, long lens. He turns around. Tank hasn't done anything yet. You're like, huh? For a moment. And then out of focus behind him, there's just this thing just explodes.
Yeah, it was in the second trailer.
It was? Okay, because it was like a cracker of a shot. It was heroic. It was well-timed. It had intelligence. It was just perfectly framed. And I'll tell you the other thing that I noticed when I saw that, I was like, man, somebody has really graded this film well, because they haven't gone for obvious kind of, you know, tinted looks and stuff, but it was very, very well graded. And I saw at the end credits that it was actually Stephen Scott, and I'll flesh up here that Stephen's actually a friend of mine and works at E-Film, did, I don't know, Jumper and Charlotte's Web and Charlie Wilson's War and stuff. But I was really glad when I noticed it to find out it was him, because he is one of the world's best film graders. And I don't know, did you like the look of the film? Because I thought it looked good.
The whole film looked really solid. It was, you know, it didn't go into kind of wacky, cartoony look. It was very, you know, it was very dramatic looking. It didn't look like a kind of the generic big budget film look where you're pushing, you know, the highs and the lows to extremes and then bloom filters and everything, and it was a really gorgeous film. The other look, by the way, which I thought was fantastic and I thought was awesome, is everything dealing with the heads up displays, that the Stark technology, whether it was the stuff on the windows and the glass in the Malibu house to the stuff inside the Iron Man suit, I thought that stuff was really fantastic look.
You know what? I agree with you so much that actually at FX Guide we contacted Devrish, who is the head of the orphanages team that did the design work for that, and we've done an interview with him that'll go up probably a day after this comes out, because I thought the same thing. I was initially expecting the heads-up display to be sort of a minor thing, but to a certain extent, a lot of that graphic design was kind of story-related and character-related. It's unbelievable that, you know, this guy could do it by himself, but once you put the artificial intelligence in there and you had this, like, you know, entire culture of his whole building and everything about it being and you know what, an extension from that, not necessarily the orphanages work, but the robotic sequence where the robots with the fire extinguishers, I mean, that was just genuinely funny. I mean,
it was genuinely funny, and what I thought was a little bit ironic is the fact that these inanimate robots that were puppeteered live on stage, obviously, emoted more character than some named, you know, above the title characters that we've seen in the past couple of years that have been done with CG. You know, that these faceless, voiceless characters, you know, you felt real emotion coming from these puppeteer things.
That great shot where it handed him the backup arc generator, and he's lying on the ground, and there's a shot looking up at just the hand of the robot, and definitely definite sidekick department, but it was great.
Yeah, it was really well done. The whole comedy part with the spritzing him with the fire extinguisher was the audience I saw it with was, you know, laughing out loud at that. It was a nice genuine character moment.
Well, you know, the orphanage spent a year, getting back to the HUD, the orphanage spent a year doing that heads up display and did three different versions as the suits progressed. And it was an interesting job to come up with that. And I thought they did a really good job. And not only that, but it's actually a darn sight harder than it looks to come up with nothing graphics that look like they mean something but don't distract from the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's you got to ground it in both the this looks really high tech and new and different to the I understand what this is supposed to be. You know, that mix of the so far beyond our technology, but yet still I get what I'm looking at is really difficult. The question I have.
Matching you for geekiness for a second, I actually bothered step framing through the sequence because the sequence of his first flight with the heads-up display is on the net on iTunes. And there's a few frames where he identifies the Audi in his line of sight, and the heads-up display actually puts up the info. And so apparently that Audi, that R8 that's sitting, is a 2010 model, and it costs $159,000 US. There you go.
Yeah, that at the ArcLight Cinemas here in Los Angeles, which is where I saw the film, they have one parked outside. Out front.
Really?
it's actually, if you're in LA and you want to find a theater to go see it at, obviously you'll want to see it at the ArcLight anyway. But they have both the Audi R8 and they have an Iron Man suit that was actually used in the movie, in the lobby. So
now this has got to be another massive Audi product placement, right? Like it was with Hitman.
Yeah, I think the kind of lingering shot of the Audi logo as he pulls into valet parking was the
racing
biggest
to the airport in the Audi for no apparent reason shot.
Yes, the or straight the out of the Michael Bay film school of car commercials. The product placement was a little bit in your face, but that and the Burger King.
What was that about?
Yeah.
Was that something from the comics that he just happened to be obsessed with hamburgers, or did somebody just pay so much money that he said, I wanted the Burger King?
I think it was so much money because, you know, looking back at Swingers, and anyone who lives in Los Angeles would very well know that if you're landing in Los Angeles after being stuck in Afghanistan, you're going to be stopping at In-N-Out Burger.
Oh, no, not you too. When we drive across to Vegas, Jeff Huser and I, we stop and Basto, I think it is, in the middle of the desert, and I'm always wanting to get something else, and he's always wants an In-N-Out Burger. You Californians are obsessed with those things.
Yeah, it's mainly because it's something that we have and other people don't.
yeah. So there's a couple of other things that I wanted to touch on real quick before we moved on. Firstly, there's apparently a really good article coming up in Cinefix magazine on the film, which is going to have a lot of information in it. And the thing I wanted to touch on was the fact that the post-production on the film involved Avid Post using basically an HD pipeline, so an entire offline process editing at HD, which I think is a bit of a first. Normally films offline at a much lower resolution. And there's been some interesting stuff on the net about using the new DNX HD codec from Avid so that they could actually edit the film incredibly high res.
Without saying too much, I'm very familiar with the Avid DNX HD36 codec. And working completely in HD all the time.
Yeah, And I think it's interesting, though, that you've moved now to offline. Obviously, it's compressed, and I'm familiar with it too because we do stuff with Red converting to it and stuff. So it is a compressed format, but still, you're getting a pretty good view of the film and certainly the details of the film at a stage when really you've got hours and hours and hours of footage to cut down, and normally you're used to looking at a postage stamp.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a much easier process for an editor and for everyone involved when you're dealing with looking at, you know, 1080p footage on a 50-inch or a 65-inch plasma screen, and going in and being able to screen your dailies and your rushes, you know, your sequence edits at HD projected probably 25 feet wide or whatever it might be in your screening room, to give you a much more sense of scope and how the film's looking and the detail. And 'cause little details matter. And
well,
I
now
think,
if ever we saw little details matter, just changing something slightly, it's the detail that ILM put into those suits in the latter shots. Because as you were saying earlier about, you know, how the suit getting constructed and stuff, I don't know if you could take your eye off the action to actually study some of that fine detail work, but they were like nailing it with them. I mean, I guess they've got such good rigid body stuff out of Transformers and stuff, but man.
Yeah, that I am so incredibly looking forward to the DVD, Blu-ray, whatever, of this movie, so I can frame by frame every little bit of the suit action, because it is a meticulously crafted. You know, you think about the fact that the armor is essentially a whole bunch of rigid objects that are put together. So even your most basic software could, you know, build something. You know, they're not using any fancy skinning technology. They're not using any fancy rigging technology. It's just really well modeled, really well surfaced, beautifully rendered and composited into these plates. And it comes across as completely grounded in the world. I was so impressed. There wasn't a single time I looked at a shot and said, oh, that's a bad composite, you know?
You know, I would like to discuss ILM's work more, but it was so good. There's not a lot to say about it. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, that stuff with the suits. And not only that, I mean, obviously it was like 32-bit compositing because the highlights were streaking correctly on the motion blur. But just, the as you said, the composites, the actual rigid body stuff in the first place, the dynamics, the fact that it actually moved with kind of, you know, the right weight. It took off slowly and, you know, decelerated poorly as it was landing. It was really good work.
I mean, because the way Hal Hickel, the animation soup, I had asked him the question, you know, how much was animated, how much was mocap and such, and what he had said is, you know, it's almost all animated, the stuff they did, but what they did do is a lot of times on set, Downey Jr. would only be wearing, for lack of the better word, the pants of the suit. And his upper body would be, you know, just wearing kind of a tight lycra thing, and that way he can act and do his thing without having to, you know, be encumbered by the suit and being tired by the suit. And then they'd have to match move it onto it. I could never tell. You know, there was not a single moment I went, oh, the arm is fake or the whatever. It was just completely and utterly seamless from top to bottom. Not a single shot in the movie stands out in my mind as even being weak. You know, there's a couple that maybe you could nitpick a little bit, but there wasn't a single shot that you felt like, oh, well, that was obviously the last one to go out the door.
No, and if there were any shots, I don't think they were in ILM sequences. I thought their work was flawless. Hey, I got to ask you a question though. When I was looking at the end credits, I didn't see a full frame ILM credit, and that's not normally the case. Normally, the screen will allow ILM's name to be the only thing on the screen, just but for a beat. Yet, given they were the primary effects house, did you notice that, or was it just me?
Actually, during the end credit sequence, I was more watching the kind of cool illustration animation thing that was going on in the background. I wasn't really – I kept on, like, wanting to watch the names, because I always try to watch the names to see if there's any of my friends that worked on it, whatever. So I was a little bit distracted by that, so I didn't notice that.
Now, you're talking about the actual title sequence itself at the end?
Yeah, that ends –
I noticed that as well.
I hope they put that on the DVD, like, without credits rolling over it, because I thought it was just really gorgeous. It kind of was, you know, it was obviously done in 3D, but it had a kind of, you know, it looked like a flash animation, but it was had a really cool, you know, look to it, and it was just very interesting to watch. So
I looked for the credit on that in the end credits, and they said Prodigy. Now, I don't know Prodigy Design or Prodigy, whoever. I mean, if somebody does, they could email me. That'd be great, because I agree with you. I noticed it enough to stop and try and find their name in the credits.
I would also like to say, you know, ILM's shots were fantastic. So were the embassies. And the fact that, you know, you have these small shops that are competing, even if it's, you know, 25 shots versus 500 shots, you know, the fact that you have these small shops that are putting up stuff that holds up with the big boys, I think, is a good thing.
Well, Embassy did, I think, 60 shots, and that was, like, mainly the cave stuff, and they had about only 20 people working there. I don't know if you've seen that VW ad that they did with the world kind of, you know, Rubik's cubing around this VW. I don't know the name of the – we don't have this particular SUV VW in Australia, but the actual ad itself is really well done. And, yeah, they definitely got on my radar, the Embassy.
Yeah, Embassy first came to my attention when because they're big users of Moto, which I'm also a big fan of.
Okay.
They seem to always do really, you know, flawless mechanical stuff. So hope to see more from them in the future.
Now, the only thing I've got to complain about, and I bitterly am disappointed in this, is that you didn't Twitter me earlier to hang around later for the end credits past the final roll, because I got your thing before I went up. And I was like, oh, David saw it. Ron Brinkman saw it. I was like, this is cool. Like, I'm going to go up. I went up there, and I get back. It's like about midnight now. I come in, sit down, just check in my there's you going, oh, don't leave before the end of the end credits. And I'm like, dude, why can you send that like an hour ago, 2 hours ago?
Is it apparently the law now in podcasts that we must now talk about Twitter?
Well, it's not so much about Twitter. It's just that, like, I didn't know to hang. So if you haven't seen the film, for the love of everything, don't do what I did. I hung for VFX credits, right? It got to audio credits, I'm out of there. I was just like, mm-hmm, and walked out because, you know, I like the film, but, you know, it's late at night and I'm going to go home.
There's an amazing little scene that comes on after the movie ends or after the credits end, and it has an amazing cameo that sets up, you know, the next two films, which, by the way, they already announced Iron Man 2 today.
Yeah, I saw that.
Including the release date of April 30th, 2010. Stay through the credits. If you haven't seen the movie, we've proceeded to ruin it over the past half hour or so. But go see the movie and stay all the way through the credits, which you really should be doing anyway, because someday, you know, your name might be up in the credits too and you want people to read it. But it's a nice little puncher to the movie at the end. Speaking of Twitter, by the way, you are the one who got me on Twitter with your.
Well, I like the fact that you're willing to give away a Avatar T-shirt to the person that's the 18,000th person to become your Twitter follower.
Not the 18,000th, it's not going to be the person. Okay, here's the deal.
Yeah.
Avatar had the code name for a very long time of being called Project 880. So when I reach 880 followers on Twitter, twitter.com/DavidStrapenis, I will pick someone randomly from all of my followers, and they will receive an Avatar Crew T-shirt.
So can I just make a point here, right? You've got 23 followers right now.
Yes.
Okay.
I
have like 300. Mind you, Alex, who's just showing off at this point, has an astonishing number. Ready for this? Alex has 2,500 people following his every move. So there you go. But hey, I didn't want to discuss Twitter. What I wanted to discuss was hanging around for those end credit things, because, you know, that's a real little gem, a little bonus for people.
And, yeah, it's a real bonus. The one thing I really wish the filmmakers would do is they should put at the beginning of the credits, stay through the credits. You know,
well,
just
or
let...
your friends could let you know a little earlier. That would have been, you know, a similar kind of thing.
Well, there's that whole time zone thing and you being on the other side of the planet. But
yeah,
I let you...
okay. If there's anything at the end of Avatar and you don't tell me about it, I'm going to personally rip your throat out. Okay, we got to go. And we want to thank our producing team in particular, because this podcast is produced by Pixel Core, and we have a great group of people that put it together each week, headed by Kirsten Martin, who does a great job, Kevin, who's been with us for a while, and Laurie, who I think I named earlier as being a new contributor. So we thank them, and they do the editing at basically in California, though it's recorded here by me, Mike Seymour, in Sydney. You can find me at fxguide.com, and fxguide.com is where we'll be doing that interview with Dava Rush about the orphanage and the head-up display. And David, where can people find you?
You can obviously find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DavidStrapreneurs. I've become totally addicted to it.
That is such a hopeless plug.
DavidStrapreneurs.com.
Okay. And are you doing any performances at the moment?
I'm not performing stand-up too much right now. We're neck deep in filming right now, so getting away for anything whatsoever. Today was a rare day that I got away before it was midnight. So,
and just wanted to say that next week we basically move the crew around on who's doing the regular performances, because literally we're all working in the industry. So, you know, any one day, if David isn't here, it's not that we didn't invite him. It's just that he might be on set, or I might be on set, or Mark or Ron or whatever. So, or Alex. So we appreciate you guys bearing with us. That's just the nature of the show. If you want to buy into the show, you have to buy into the fact that we're a rotating group of people, just simply because we're all practicing in the industry. I'm going to say goodbye and let you go to sleep. For me personally, I'm going to go out and get some sushi.
All right.
See you later, mate.
Have a good day and keep it real.
See you then. Bye.